This is the first day of this November 2007 7-day session. And before we begin, just a few words about the status of this retreat center. The big news is that we got our certificate of occupancy a day or two ago, which means that's what we needed to enable us to use these 11 or so new bedrooms here in the phase two of this retreat center. We've had the bedrooms, but we haven't been able to use them in recent months. We have the bedrooms now. We have further to go in furnishing them, getting them up to snuff. The courtyard is probably the most obvious unfinished part of this phase two of the project. We'll have to wait until next spring to start putting our Japanese maples and other bushes and things in that in the courtyard. Although we are scheduled next week to start building up what is a kind of a little bit of a bathtub there in that courtyard with soil. The altar is beautiful, I think, but it's that too is temporary. We'll have a hardwood altar the way we do at Arnold Park, but it won't be for a while yet. The area outside the Zendo, right in front of the Zendo, right now has some scraps of carpet strips sort of patched in there, but that will be the same oak flooring as we have here in the Zendo. It'll just spill out there and go off in both directions. Of course, I think everyone knows the Doksan room and waiting line that we're using now is a temporary arrangement. The area that we designed to include a Doksan room and waiting line has yet to be built. That's our phase three. And in phase three, there'll be more bedrooms, bathrooms, showers. Here in the Zendo, the tons are now, they're just unfinished plywood surface. We'll have these covered with the goza. Goza is that, what I have always in the past called tatami. Tatami is the straw, the woven straw, Japanese surface that we have at Arnold Park. It'll be the same thing here. The facing of the tons that we're all sitting on now will have be finished with cherry. And no doubt there are other things I'm not thinking of, smaller things that we have yet to do, trim and throughout the building and other things. But it does seem to work pretty well already. So for this these first few teishos of the sesshin, we're going to walk on the wild side and go back to our old friend Hakuin. I haven't done him in a few years. I think the last time I did him in Taisho, I just thought he was just so out there in his raging at everyone who has arms and legs. But, you know, he is the Japanese Rinzai teacher. He is the master. He and Dogen. Dogen is the Soto school. Hakuin is the Rinzai school, and I don't want to go for too many years without people being exposed to his extraordinary spirit and his insight. So let's start with the biographical material we have. I'm reading from a book called The Essential Teachings of Zen Master Hakuin, and the translator is Norman Waddell. And I'll be reading here from the translator's introduction. Hakuin was born and spent his entire life, except for the years he was wandering the country on his Zen pilgrimage, in the tiny farming village of Hara, situated near the foot of Mount Fuji. He was, by all accounts, inclined strongly toward religion at a very early age. When he was 15, he entered religious life at the neighborhood Zen temple, Shōinji. The head priest, who shaved his head, was a family friend. He gave the young novice the name Ekaku, which Hakuin would use until his 30s, when he was established as abbot of Shōinji himself, he adopted the additional name Hakuin. If you've ever been confused by the different names of the masters, both the ancient teachers and even contemporary teachers, you can be forgiven because there's a whole system of name changing that happens that I've never taken the time to try to understand. There's your family name, then there's a name maybe that you were given when you were originally ordained as a novice, and then one as in your full ordination, then maybe one later when you became, as in this case, when he became the abbot of the temple. And then there's another name that you may be bestowed, the really great, the greatest of the greats were bestowed upon when they were named national teacher by the emperor, and they were given another name. After becoming abbot of this tiny neighborhood temple, 4 years later, this was long before he became abbot. 4 years into his, after he was ordained, his teacher let him go out on a pilgrimage to meet other Zen teachers. And these wanderings of Hakuin's lasted 14 years, taking him throughout most areas of the main island of Japan. And after this period of travel and teaching from many Zen teachers, but mostly practicing on his own, when he was 31, he sequestered himself in a remote hermitage in the mountains and determined to make an all-out effort to attain a final breakthrough. While he was there, news reached him that his father had fallen critically ill and wanted him to return and live at Shōinji, which was now vacant and in need of a priest. Hakuin reluctantly agreed to do that, and that ended his years of pilgrimage. He says here that the temple that he inherited, this Shōinji, was not only small and insignificant, quote, a branch temple of a branch temple, it was also penniless. Its buildings were neglected and in an advanced stage of decay. And this is what a biography of Hakuin, compiled by his disciple Tore, said about it. Shōwenji had fallen into an almost indescribable state of ruin. Stars shone through the roof at night. The floors were constantly saturated by rain and dew. It was necessary for the master to wear a straw raincoat as he moved about the temple attending to his duties. He needed sandals inside the main hall when he went there to conduct ceremonies. Temple assets had passed into the hands of creditors. The temple equipment had all been pawned. About the only thing worth noting around here, he said, is the moonlight and the sound of the wind. Hakuin stayed at this little temple until his death 50 years later. Here's another passage from Tore's biography of Hakuin about his life during the first 10 years of his residency. He applied himself single-mindedly to his practice. He endured great privation without ever deviating from his spare, simple way of life. He didn't adhere to any fixed schedule for sutra chanting or other temple rituals. When darkness fell, he would climb inside a derelict old palanquin and seat himself on a cushion he placed on the floorboard. One of the young boys at the temple would come, wrap the master's body in a futon, and cinch him up tightly into this position with ropes. There he would remain motionless, like a painting of Bodhidharma, until the following day when the boy would come to untie him so that he could relieve his bowels and take some food. The same routine was repeated nightly. We're told here that he had had his first kensho at the age of 24 during his pilgrimage years. In the years that followed, he had other awakening experiences. And then here, there's a quote, large ones and small ones in numbers beyond count. They had deepened and broadened his original enlightenment, but he still did not feel free. He was unable to integrate his realization into his ordinary life and felt restricted when he attempted to express his understanding to others. The final decisive enlightenment that brought his long religious quest to an end occurred on a spring night in 1726 when he was 41. He was reading the Lotus Sutra at the time. It was the chapter on parables, where the Buddha cautions his disciple Shariputra against savoring the joys of personal enlightenment and reveals to him the truth of the Bodhisattva's mission, which is to continue practice beyond enlightenment, teaching and helping others until all beings have attained liberation. And these were Hakuin's own words about this final realization of his own account of it. He said, "A cricket made a series of chirrs at the foundation stones of the temple. The instant they reached the master's ears, he was one with enlightenment. Doubts and uncertainties that had burdened him from the beginning of his religious quest suddenly dissolved and ceased to exist. From that moment on, he lived in a state of great emancipation. The enlightening activities of the Buddhas and patriarchs, the Dharma eye to grasp the sutras, they were now his, without any doubt, without any lack whatever." This point, we're told here, this also marked a turning point from his focus on awakening himself to directing all of his energy toward helping others awaken. So that's when he was 41. It says, during his late 30s and 40s, Hakuin accepted a small but growing number of students. His reputation slowly grew and spread until by his early 50s, when he composed these introductory talks, his name was known and respected even in the halls of the great Myoshinji in Kyoto. The lecture meeting of 1740, according to Tore, established Hakuin as the foremost Zen teacher in the land. Monks and nuns and lay people from all over the country began to converge on Shōinji. Shōinji barely supplied its own needs. It was unable to accommodate even a small number of students, let alone the hundreds who were coming to receive instruction. Most of those who came were obliged to find lodging elsewhere. They slept and practiced in private houses and abandoned dwellings, unused temples and halls, ruined shrines, under the eaves of farmhouses. Some even camped out under the stars. The whole countryside for miles around the temple was transformed into a great center for Zen practice. It was a new kind of Buddhist assembly, formed and maintained by the monks themselves. The records speak of the great awe in which Hakuin was held by his students. Tore remembered him as a sheer cliff towering abruptly before him, a menacing presence stalking the temple like a great ox, glaring around with the eyes of an angry tiger. The only students who remained, so though these hundreds came, not all of them stayed. The only ones who stayed were those who had come to train with the same deep motivation that had driven Hakuin. In a preface to Hakuin's a book by Hakuin, Idle Talks on a Night Boat, he drew a famous passage of a picture of life at Shōinji. So these are Hakuin's words. From the moment monks set foot inside Shōinji's gates, they gladly endured the poisonous slobber the master spewed at them. They welcomed the stinging blows from his stick. Students stayed for 10, even 20 years, the thought of leaving never entering their minds. Some had resolved to lay down their lives there and become dust under the temple pine trees. They were the finest flowers of the Zen groves, dauntless heroes to all the world. They faced hunger in the morning, freezing cold by night, sustaining themselves on wheat chaff and raw vegetables, they heard nothing but the master's blistering shouts and abuse, felt nothing but bone-piercing blows from his furious fist and stick. They saw sights that made their foreheads furrow. They heard things that made their bodies pour with sweat. There were scenes that would have brought tears to a demon's eyes and would have caused a devil to press his palms together in supplication. When these monks first arrived, they were in radiant health with glowing skins, but before long their bodies were thin and emaciated, their faces drawn. None of them could have been held a moment longer were they not totally dedicated to their quest, begrudging neither health nor life itself. I think we can figure there's a little bit of hyperbole in here, as we'll hear as we go on in the next few days, just what an extraordinary language Hakuin used pretty much all the time. And then the translator tells us, Hakuin, however, was not always the flint-eyed teacher striking terror into the hearts of Zen students. He was also a man of great warmth and kindness and humor, who shared the life of his fellow villagers and was deeply sympathetic to their needs. When he was not engaged in training his regular students, he was trying to reach out through writing and painting to educate the farmers, fishermen, and others of his native region and bring them closer to the truth of the Buddhist teaching. The records show that the pace of Hakuin's teaching actually picked up over the final 25 years of his life. He lectured regularly at Shoenji and other temples in the area on a wide range of Buddhist sutras and Zen texts. Invitations came from other temples and lay groups around the country asking him to conduct meetings, which probably means sesshins or... He willingly made journeys of days, even weeks, in order to respond to them. In his 60s on, he turned more and more to writing, painting, and calligraphy to communicate his message. He left over 50 written works, ranging from difficult Zen discourses and specialized commentaries in Chinese designed for Zen students all the way to simple songs, recitations, and chants in which he couched his Zen message in a highly colloquial language to make it accessible to the common people. Another characteristic seen throughout his work is his frequent and detailed reference to the circumstances of his own religious enlightenment. Yeah, this is unusual. Most of the great masters didn't refer much to their enlightenment. The translator uses these accounts of his own enlightenment. His enlightenments, in the same way that he did the stories of the Zen teachers of the past to encourage students in their practice by telling them of the difficulties that others had experienced and overcome in the course of their Zen training. His painting and calligraphy works numbered in the thousands. I'm just going to start the first chapter by Hakuin. And the translation of the title of this chapter is Licking Up Shi Kong's Fox Slobber. And he says here, I was blown by the winds of karma to this broken-down old temple at the beginning of the Kyoho era. That's the early 1700s. I have remained here without disciples for the past 20 years. In that time, I have been visited by students from all corners of the land, asking me to give them talks on sutras and Zen writings. Some of them brought me rosters bearing names of hundreds of students. Others submitted their requests in elaborate compositions that were 20 or 30 lines long. Altogether, this must have happened at least 30 times. I can't tell you how it has interfered with my sleep. I'm skipping around here a little bit. He says, I am deeply concerned about the sharp decline in Buddhist practice in recent years and the sad decay of the Dharma. The young generation of monks are a pack of misfits, irresponsible and ungovernable rascals. When they first come to me, I cannot help loving them for their quiet, unassuming manner. My head bows before their sincere devotion and firm resolve. I think they are genuine monks, determined to break through to enlightenment. Their thoughts are fixed firmly on the great matter of birth and death. But before even a month is up, they turn from the exemplary norms and customs of the past as they would from dirt. The time-honored temple regulations mean no more to them than lumps of dry mud. They band together in groups and run roughshod through the temple, roaming the garden and corridors, shouting out to one another in loud voices, loitering in passageways, singing and humming. They pay no attention to what their superiors tell them. Senior priests and temple masters are powerless to restrain them. They cut the bucket rope at the wall. They lift the temple bell from its moorings and turn it upside down. What are we supposed to do with this? They push over the big temple drum. Whenever they get the chance, they sneak out the front gate. They slink furtively back in at night through openings they have burrowed in the temple wall. They gather in front of the main hall, capering about and singing shameless tunes they pick up in town. They swarm over the hill and back of the temple like ants, disturbing others with their wild clapping and horsing around. This is where Hakuin really cuts loose with his imagination. They prop sharp sickles up in dark corridors where the unsuspecting will walk into them. Stack big water jars in passageways where people will be sure to knock them over. They crack the floor planks over the privy so that when men squat on them, they will tumble into the pit filth. They plague the kitchen monks by dousing the firewood with water so it can't be used to light the ovens in the morning. Now that I don't believe. They would be interfering with their own breakfast. They make the rounds of the local tea houses and wine shops, gleefully abandoning themselves to base amusements. While there could be 1,000 people inside the temple devoting themselves to their training with untiring zeal, because they do not venture outside the gates for the entire retreat, no one knows of their illustrious achievements. The rowdy miscreants haunting the town streets, engrossed in these unsavory pastimes, may be no more than 2 or 3 in number, but since it all takes place in broad daylight for everyone to see, their sins become known to all. Ah, because of the mindless and irresponsible actions of a handful of monks, tens of thousands of their fellows must share their notoriety. Jades are cast into the furnace along with ordinary stones. gold and steel are melted into one common lump. Buddhist monks have come to be despised by good laymen and women. Now they are as welcome as a shit-covered pig or a mangy dog with running sores. People in the streets condemn them. Even the masterless samurai talk of their flagrant misdeeds. Now that's getting bad. Even the masterless samurai. And he goes on raging about these supposed characters. Pages of ranting about these good-for-nothing monks. Well, I think this goes on to the end of this chapter. So before going into the next chapter, let's save that for tomorrow. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.